this is Derek Frost from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Triangle Business Journal. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. And we start on the front page of the Triangle Business Journal with the cover story headline, Tough Enough, How Biodelivery Sciences CEO Mark Sergo Grappled to Save His Company from Near Death. And that's the headline with a picture of him on the front page. And then the article actually starts within the Triangle Business Journal with another headline, Alive and Ticking, How Biodelivery Sciences CEO Mark Sergo Built a Future from Failure. And this article is written by Jason DeBrun. Mark Sergo is a street fighter. He's not going to be denied when he wants to reach a certain goal. He has really worked against the odds. Those are the words of Clay Thorpe, a general partner with Hatteras Venture Partners, a life sciences investment group, talking about Mark Sergo, the CEO of Raleigh's Biodelivery Sciences International, a small publicly traded drug developer. As many in the industry know, being a fighter is necessary. Over the years, Sergo fought off one of the largest hedge funds in the country, Clinical Development Capital, when it tried to take control of biodelivery, claiming it violated investor agreements. He fought off another drug developer, Monosol RX, claiming biodelivery infringed on its patents. Now he's fighting off a much larger drug company, Reckitt Benckiser, which says biodelivery's recently approved drug, Bunavail, infringes on its patents. A dog-eat-dog industry. Sergo has an athletic frame and runs 16 to 20 miles per week. In the local drug development scene, he's somewhat of a lone wolf, but plays on the major stage at events like the J.P. Morgan Investor Conference, the most important conference for the life sciences industry. Often, Sergo makes a presentation. The stock price sees a nice bump. He's a fabulous presenter, says Larry Robbins of the Wyrick Robbins Law Firm in Raleigh, who has worked with Sergo professionally for more than a dozen years and is also a friend. He's scrappy, Robbins says. He's wiry. He's got unbelievable energy and dedication for what he's doing. If he's on your side, you know you've got somebody behind your back who will be with you in the trenches. Although Sergo participates at major conferences, he's not one to go anywhere just to be seen. He's a guy that gets very focused, Thorpe says. He doesn't spend a lot of time networking. He just doesn't do it. Of course, employees at Biodelivery know that means he expects the same dedication of them. If you're on his team, he expects you to work your rear end off and dedicate yourself the same way he is to excellence, Robin says. Sergo compliments his employees, though. The worst four-letter word is can't, he says. I've never heard that word around here, and it's refreshing. That's important in the drug development world, where tiny changes can make huge differences. Not only is the pharmaceutical industry a dog-eat-dog world, but a world where you must operate with precision, Robin says. If you're mediocre in the drug world, you're never going to get anything approved. The entrepreneurial bug. Earlier in his career, Sergo, a doctor of pharmacy, was the sixth Research Triangle area hire for Glaxo and worked under Fred Eshelman. After 17 years, he followed Eshelman to PPD, the contract research organization Eshelman founded. Eshelman asked Sergo to head up business development, and while there, the company grew from sales of $150 million to $500 million. But Sergo wanted to run his own company. I think it's that entrepreneurial bug more than anything, says Robbins. Sergo describes himself as an entrepreneurial person who longed to get back on the product side and leaned on people like Eshelman, Thorpe and Robbins to start a drug company. He founded Arius Pharmaceuticals with longtime friend Andrew Finn, a company that was later acquired by Biodelivery, which then tapped Sergo as CEO. Life after failure. A little more than 2 years ago, Biodelivery reported a failed drug trial and things began to look grim. Potential drug partners scattered and investors sent the share price into the penny stock range. That's sort of gut-wrenching, Sergo says of a failed trial, a potential death knell for a pharmaceutical developer. Sergo calls that time in late September 2011 a near-death experience for BDSI. We always felt like we're fighting for our lives anyway, he says, of running a small company, always in search of cash. If you fail, you've got only yourself to blame. That's what drives entrepreneurs. That's a good attitude, but attitude alone doesn't bring in money, and Sergo needed money. The drug under development was called buprenorphine, a pain medication for cancer patients delivered through BioDelivery's patented film strip that is placed inside the cheek. Until that Phase 3 trial, Sergo and team felt confident about its success and had begun negotiations with larger drug companies. With the failed trial, the offers dried up, and even the eventual partner, Endo Pharmaceuticals, withdrew its term sheet. But there was still a lifeline. In January, Sergo was able to convince Endo that he and his team of scientists knew what they did wrong in the failed trial and would be able to get it right the next time. Sergo says the data from the trial wasn't all negative, and he tried to convince the investors of that point. You could argue we didn't do a very good job because the share price went down to a buck, he says. Again, that's easy to say, but much more difficult to swallow on Endo's side of the negotiating table, especially for the kind of money Sergo was asking for. BioDelivery ultimately struck a deal with Endo on January 6, 2012, that paid Sergo's company $30 million upfront and could result in BioDelivery's receiving as much as $180 million, depending on royalty revenues. A breakthrough product. Fast forward to June 6 of this year, BioDelivery has taken BEMA buprenorphine nearly to a new drug application submission with the U.S. Food and Drug Administration and garnered enough money from Endo and a private fundraiser to develop a drug called Bunavail for opiate dependence. Importantly, for Bunavail, BioDelivery didn't need a partner, so it will keep all revenue. Bunavail, a combination of buprenorphine and naloxone delivered on the film strip, enters a market that already has a buprenorphine and naloxone mix, but in pill form. It's a $1.5 billion market, and analysts estimate BioDelivery could reach peak annual sales of $250 million. In early July, BioDelivery expects results of a Phase 3 study of BEMA buprenorphine in opiate experienced patients. If positive, BioDelivery would move forward with Endo, filing an NDA in late 2014 or early 2015. Even if the results aren't totally positive, Sergo says he'll be upfront about it. Tell the truth, he says, they'll accept the bad news a whole lot better. And along with this cover story article, there's a box that's headlined Closer Look. President, CEO, Mark Sergo. Company, BioDelivery Sciences International. Education, BS in Pharmacy, Ohio State University. PharmD, Philadelphia College of Pharmacy and Science. Years with company, 9. Age, 60, but I feel 40. Family, wife Linda, daughter Megan, an ICU nurse at WakeMed Health and Hospitals. Hobbies, fitness and running. Music, listens to a lot of U2. And then there is also another section headlined How It Works. Bunavail is indicated for the treatment of opiate dependence. It combines buprenorphine and naloxone on a film strip placed on the inside of the cheek. If taken properly, the buprenorphine, the opiate, is absorbed into the bloodstream and the naloxone is simply absorbed in the GI tract and excreted. But if the drug is abused, the naloxone is mixed with the buprenorphine and the abuser goes into withdrawal symptoms. This serves as a deterrent to abuse. A similar drug called Suboxone is already on the market in pill form. BioDelivery Sciences claims that Bunavail has twice the bioavailability, drug absorbed into the body, of buprenorphine compared to Suboxone. As a result, plasma concentrations of buprenorphine comparable to Suboxone can be achieved with half the dose. And finally, there's a section headlined BDSI Timeline, mapping the pulse of BioDelivery Sciences under Sergo's leadership. The BioDelivery share price had bounced mostly along the $2 to $4 range, with a slight bump in mid-2009 because of a positive indication for Onsolis. The near-death experience came in late 2011 after BioDelivery reported failed trial results, sending investors scattering. As the company worked back, however, Wall Street began to take notice. Seven analyst firms have now initiated coverage, and all have given the company a buy or outperform rating. In fact, William Blair has even pegged the price target at $23, the highest of all analyst groups. We believe the Bonneville label reflects a best-in-class therapy, according to a William Blair research note from June 9. Systemic naloxone exposure may lead to withdrawal symptoms, and this decreased exposure cited in the label may be a significant marketing tool for product differentiation. As with virtually every CEO of a publicly traded company, Surgo says the stock is undervalued and predicts a bump as sales begin to roll in. Then the timeline, October 2006, share price $2. April 25th, 2007, stock soars on positive phase 3 clinical trial data for BEMA fentanyl, later named Onsolis, a drug to relieve pain for cancer patients. September 5, 2007, BioDelivery signs $90 million marketing partnership with Swedish company Media Pharmaceuticals. September 10, 2007, BioDelivery pays $3 million to QLT to acquire full rights of the BEMA drug delivery technology. April 7, 2008, BioDelivery's annual report includes growing concern statement from auditors. August 25, 2008, company receives positive news from FDA on Onsolis, though does not receive full approval of the drug. June 15, 2009, FDA indicates approval for Onsolis. Mid-July 2010, company announces it will sell additional shares to raise $10 million to develop BEMA buprenorphine. September 29, 2011, BioDelivery does not receive results it had hoped on a pivotal phase 3 trial on BEMA buprenorphine. January 6, 2012, company signs deal with Endo Pharma. October 1, 2012, stock continues to climb based on Endo deal and positive results on drug trials related to BEMA buprenorphine and buprenorphine naloxone mix, which will later be named Bonneville. January 24, 2014, BioDelivery receives positive phase 3 for BEMA buprenorphine for chronic pain. And June 9, 2014, Bonneville approved. And now we turn inside the Triangle Business Journal to Biz, a quick glance at Triangle happenings, written by managing editor Rebecca Troyer. Beer tech firm tips hat to Raleigh Brewer. Jason Austin wouldn't have a business without Lone Rider Brewing Company. Austin, the CEO of Raleigh-based beer technology firm Pint Labs, acquired by SteadyServe this month, tells Biz he thought he liked beer until that day on the Lone Rider porch years ago. A sip of Shotgun Betty changed his outlook. It was good, he says. From then on, he realized beer wasn't something you just drink, it's something you're supposed to enjoy. And to spread the message via technology, he started his company. For your inspiration, drink local. He recommends ending the day with a Lone Rider Peacemaker. Local foodies pen book for restaurateurs. If you're thinking of starting your own restaurant or have a restaurant and aren't up to date on your social media skills, you might want to pay attention to what these two have to say. Local social media extraordinaires, Kristen Ballman of Gadabout Food, and former Visit Raleigh food blogger, along with former PDQ general manager, Brooks Briz, have recently released a new book. Hashtag Hungry, Fuel Your Restaurant Sales with Social Media. The book offers tips to increase restaurant sales with examples of how local Triangle restaurants climb to the next level. We decided to write this book because we saw a general opportunity for restaurateurs and managers to learn how to successfully use social media platforms, Bauman says. A portion of the sales proceeds will go towards the No Kid Hungry organization, a charity highly involved in the restaurant industry dedicated to feeding hungry children across America. Hamlin honored by Red Cross. The Triangle chapter of the American Red Cross had another special surprise for Bill Hamlin, one of its biggest, longtime supporters, at the chapter's annual meeting on June 24 at the Cardinal Club in downtown Raleigh. The chapter had commissioned a portrait of Hamlin's late wife, Christine Hamlin, who had also been a big supporter of the Red Cross before she passed away last August. But what Hamlin didn't know was that he was also being honored that night with the chapter's biggest honor, the Humanitarian of the Year Award. Past winners have included psychiatrist and philanthropist Dr. Asad Mamandi and Thinking Maps President Sherwin Sudreth, who were both on hand to present the award to Hamlin. NCMH exhibit wins Merit Award. Congrats go out to the North Carolina Museum of History in Raleigh on its Award of Merit from the American Association for State and Local History, Leadership in History Awards for the exhibit, Watergate, Political Scandal, and the Presidency. The exhibit began on May 17, 2013, and will run through August 10, 2014 at the museum. The exhibit also highlights former North Carolina Senator Sam Ervin Jr. and other North Carolinians, including Rufus Edmiston, who played key roles in the investigation. Sipping tea on the porch, Carolina style. The Carolina Inn in Chapel Hill was recently named number 4 on Fedor's Best Hotel Porches in the U.S. The historic inn, built in 1924, is located on campus of UNC Chapel Hill and is a member of the Historic Hotels of America. Fedor's writes, "The inn has long been a genteel gathering place for students, faculty, and the community, and many of these gatherings have happened on its expansive front porch and lawn. The Carolina Inn is currently in its 12th season of Fridays on the Porch, featuring live music on the porch and grounds." And finally, public art for Tar Heels who stare at goats. Local businesses are teaming up with area artists for a public art display in Chapel Hill and Pittsboro, known as the Goat Parade. The parade will take the form of art installations, including painted goats at University Mall and around Chapel Hill and Pittsboro. Why goats? The Galloway Ridge Retirement Community, host of the art auction at the end of the Goat Parade, sits beside Farrington Village in Pittsboro, which is known for belted cows as well as goats. "There are a lot of goats in the area," says Pat Richardson, director of communications at Galloway Ridge. "The cow parade has been done. We didn't want to duplicate an event and wanted to brand an event on our own. It's a quiet animal. They deserve some recognition." And now we turn to the reporter pages in the Triangle Business Journal. And first we have the page of Amanda Hoyle, who covers commercial and residential real estate. The main headline, "Sundry Uses Possible for Old Hotel. Water Park, Church, Disaster Center Among Options for Site." The owner of the dilapidated Capitol Plaza Hotel in North Raleigh has given up on plans to renovate and reopen as a high-end hotel and is instead exploring options for redevelopment. And, at least for now, no idea is off the table. Through an auction sale in 2011, hotel investor Balbir Bill Brar of Fayetteville acquired the 272-room hotel buildings at 2815 Capitol Boulevard, and he had said at the time he planned to renovate the rooms and reopen it as a hotel, located at the intersection of Highwoods Boulevard. By that time, the 8-acre former Holiday Inn property had already been closed for about 10 years. Brar paid $1.4 million for the property, anticipating to be able to capitalize on its $4.8 million tax value. But 3 years later, Brar hasn't been able to secure the financing needed to finish the renovations, And he's hired Raleigh commercial real estate broker Sanjay Mundra of Howard Perry and Walston Commercial to market the site. This building has been sitting empty here for so long, something needs to happen, Mundra says. Among the ideas that Mundra is pitching to potential buyers and developers include an indoor water park and hotel concept that would be a scaled-down version of the Great Wolf Lodge in Concord, a nonprofit partnership or deal with a large church organization that could convert the 30,000-square-foot lobby into a sanctuary and use the hotel suites for offices and meeting spaces, a training center building for a technical or community college program, a national call center for a company needing plenty of parking options, or a disaster response center for an agency like the American Red Cross that could be coupled with other organizations seeking other shelter needs. And another article on this page, headlined, Chapel Hill OKs Glen Lennox Project. The Chapel Hill Town Council, in an almost anticlimactic vote on June 23, approved a development agreement that's been more than 6 years in the making with the owners of the historic Glen Lennox Apartment and Shopping Center community in Chapel Hill. The development agreement will now allow Glen Lennox owner, Grub Properties, to begin planning the first phases of redevelopment for the 70-acre site on prime real estate at the intersection of U.S. 15501 and NC 54 in Chapel Hill. It'll also be the first new development proposed in more than 60 years for Glen Lennox, a circa 1950 neighborhood of single-story apartment buildings and a retail shopping center. Grub Properties and the town council and staff spent 2 years hashing out the details for a development agreement that prescribes specific setback requirements, building height restrictions, and what building uses will be allowed on the property. And now we have the reporter page for Jason DeBrun, who covers healthcare and biopharmaceuticals. The first headline, Grifols opens $370 million plant. Clayton-based plasma producer will add at least 200 workers. Grifols, a producer of plasma-derived medicines, celebrated the grand opening of its newest facility in Clayton. When fully operational, the facility will employ more than 200 and almost double its plasma production capacity to 6 million liters annually. Grifols products are used to treat rare, chronic diseases like neurological disorders, immune diseases, and hemophilia. The company is headquartered in Catalonia, the province in Spain that includes Barcelona, and employs more than 13,200 worldwide, including 1,650 in Johnston County, and 2,300 statewide. It also has a facility in Research Triangle Park. We have always been focused toward the U.S., said Victor Grifols, company president and CEO, and the grandson of its founder. Indeed, the company employs 10,000 workers in the United States and has invested more than $7 billion here, making it the largest Spanish investor in this country. For me to work in this country is easier than at home, Grifols said. Governor Pat McCrory was also on hand and touted the relationships established between the two countries and the company to expand pharmaceutical production. The reliance on manufacturing here in North Carolina is very strong, he said. We cannot live off the service sector alone. The 155,000-square-foot manufacturing facility represents a $370 million investment. Arthur Mas, president of Catalonia, also attended the event, along with various other dignitaries from Spain, primarily from Catalonia. Now that the production facility has opened, the next step will be obtaining U.S. Food and Drug Administration approval to begin making drugs. For now, Grifols workers will produce the plasma product for testing only. After a process that could take up to 10 months, Grifols will seek approval from the FDA to begin distributing the active drug in the market. Duke awarded $15 million for autism study. Duke Medicine received $15 million for research that explores the use of umbilical cord blood cells to treat autism, stroke, cerebral palsy, and related brain disorders. The award from the Marcus Foundation, an Atlanta-based philanthropic organization, will fund the first 2 years of a planned five-year, $41 million project by Dr. Joanne Kurtzberg, Chief Scientific and Medical Officer of Duke's Robertson Cell and Translational Therapy Program, and Geraldine Dawson, Director of the Duke Center for Autism Diagnosis and Treatment. Duke University, and Kurtzberg specifically, has been a trailblazer in studying the benefits of umbilical cord blood. In 1993, for example, it performed the world's first successful transplant of unrelated cord blood. In 2012, Duke University School of Medicine received approval from the U.S. Food and Drug Administration to market DuCord, spelled D-U-C-O-R-D, a stem cell product, making it only the third bank in the United States to receive that designation. Kurtzberg and Dawson hope to develop cell-based therapies that can potentially restore brain function in people with the disorders, for which there are currently are no cures. If successful, the study could identify therapies for further evaluation in clinical trials to potentially decrease disabilities and improve the quality of life for millions of children and adults. There are some 2 million people in the United States with autism spectrum disorder, a group of conditions affecting social communication and behavior. Strokes kill an average of nearly 130,000 in the U.S. every year, while cerebral palsy currently affects an estimated 764,000 children and young adults. And finally on this page, in a section marked Awards and Honors, Small Business Administration honors two Durham pharma companies for research. Two Durham pharmaceutical companies received a Tibbetts Award from the U.S. Small Business Administration. The award honors outstanding small businesses and individuals who participate in the SBA's Small Business Innovation Research and Small Business Technology Transfer programs. Winning the awards were Novan Therapeutics, which is developing products related to dermatology, and Parian Sciences, which is developing products to fight respiratory and ophthalmology diseases. And continuing in the Triangle Business Journal, we move to the reporter page for Dawn Curry, who covers small business, personalities, and Triangle trends. And her main article has the headline, Solar Shingles Make Shiny Debut in Cary. A Cary homeowner has become the first person in the Triangle, and most likely in North Carolina, to have solar shingles installed on his home. Don Hyatt says people have been stopping by his house to admire the shiny new roof. I've been waiting for them to become available in North Carolina, Hyatt says. It's not like solar panels, which have the big blue rectangles that stick up above everything else and are obtrusive looking. These blend in nicely. SunDollar Energy of Raleigh, owned by Dan Lazema, installed shingles that double as solar panels. The shingles came from Dow Powerhouse, a division of Dow Chemical Company, which manufactures the shingles in Michigan. It's a building-integrated PV photovoltaic module, Lazema says. Solar panel and listing roofing material in one. It's perfect for a new home or a home that needs a new roof, and the HOA won't allow for traditional solar panels. Lazema says the installation wasn't easy, and the cost of materials was double or more than what he pays for solar panels. He says he hand-nailed all 306 solar shingles onto the roof himself. He's already got another solar shingles customer in Chapel Hill, and others in Cary have expressed interest, he says. The Cary homeowner needed to replace his roof and decided after researching the product to up the ante. The total cost is $15,000. According to Dow Powerhouse, the shingles are hail-resistant and were tested for wind and storm resistance. Dow Powerhouse has signed on 12 contractors across the state who are certified to install the product. Dow Powerhouse currently has 3 employees in North Carolina. And in a by-the-numbers section, a Washington Post reporter wanted to compare how many museums and gun retailers there were in any given area. So he created an interactive map of every U.S. county and listed how many of each are in each county. while the reporter, Christopher Ingraham, breaks out the highest libraries, museums to gun stores ratio, New York with 457 libraries or museums and 11 gun stores, and findings by region, guns are king in the lower Midwest and upper South. I broke out triangle counties for you. In Wake County, 100 libraries or museums, 99 gun stores. In Durham County, 36 libraries and museums, 29 gun stores. Orange County, 33 libraries and museums, 7 gun stores. Lee County, 6 libraries, museums, 17 gun stores. Johnston County, 16 libraries and museums, 42 gun stores. Moore County, 20 libraries and museums, 26 gun stores. Franklin County, 9 libraries and museums, 14 gun stores. And in Chatham County, 9 libraries or museums, and 18 gun stores. And finally on this page, we have a She Said It section featuring Delisa Alexander, Executive Vice President and Chief People Officer at Red Hat, on hiring millennials. When it comes to hiring millennials, what are the biggest challenges? What are the advantages to having millennials on the team? What we frequently hear on the challenge side is that millennials are outspoken, seem to feel entitled, and expect for their opinions to be heard without having paid their dues, and so on. But what we have learned is that when employers and managers see millennials through that lens, they're setting themselves up for conflict and frustration, and in the long term will likely find that they are deprived of the talent that they need to be successful. Why? Because millennials now make up about a third of the U.S. workforce, and in less than a decade, they'll be nearly half of all workers. The fact is, employers and managers will have to learn to embrace what's different about millennials and figure out how to engage and inspire them. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to the reporter page of Lauren Onsorge, who covers technology and entrepreneurship. The first headline, Bull City Forward backs off co-working. It's been nearly 12 months since Kiva Case took over as executive director of Durham-based Bull City Forward, and the entrepreneurial support organization, while still on a mission, is a completely different initiative than it was in 2013. For starters, it no longer has an office, but that's about to change. Case tells me BCF is about to make its triumphant return to downtown Durham. In an exclusive chat, Case opens up about what BCF has been doing under the radar for the past year and how it still plans to change the world. Case, who took over for co-founder Chris Gergen in June of 2013, tells me in no uncertain terms that the board saw the reality of what was coming down the pipe. Financially, they made a smart move, he says. That move was shifting away from real estate entirely. With the rise of American Underground and Bull City Coworking, the need in that space just wasn't as intense as it was when Gergen and his partners started BCF. So BCF had to pivot. Last year, BCF hosted coworkers at a cozy space on Main Street downtown, and membership fees from entrepreneurs representing a big chunk of the revenue. In 2012, the most recent financials available, of the $133,083 in total BCF revenue, membership dues accounted for $51,429, or nearly 40%. And today, there are no members. BCF's pivot refocused its efforts in three areas: a fellowship program for social entrepreneurs, a charitable innovation channel dubbed Innovation Challenge, and a space repurposing program. We provide funding, access to key relationships, and helpful information and knowledge for social entrepreneurs that we believe are making a difference in the world through their enterprise efforts, Kay says. The Innovation Challenge connects charities with entrepreneurs in order to solve social problems. The latest effort is a partnership with the United Way of the Greater Triangle. The problem this time around is childhood hunger, with innovators asked to come up with ways to solve the hunger crisis in the Triangle. More than 40 applications from everyone from government groups to nonprofits have applied to compete for the $50,000 prize. It's one big idea, Kay says. We've been brought on to solve this problem. The third aspect, space repurposing, is still in the concept phase. It's hopefully giving entrepreneurs access to downtown Durham, he says. The goal is to identify space that's not being used downtown and repurpose it with entrepreneurs. We would like to animate an underutilized space downtown or an unused space downtown that is currently not producing any revenue for the building owner. We would go in and help populate that space, recruit social entrepreneurs that match with our value set. Case envisions a curated team of social entrepreneurs that would have their own anchor office in downtown, but he says it's not the co-working space you saw at the old Bull City Forward. There's already a bulk of co-working space, and that's one of the reasons for the pivot. You're always in the first year of your five-year strategic plan, and you want to make sure your receivables are years out, he says. As the board saw venues such as American Underground in Durham emerge, they spotted an increasingly competitive landscape. Instead of extended further effort, they went back to the mission, Kay says, but now I think it's time we reemerge downtown. While Case is excited about the changes, he does acknowledge that it's been difficult flying under the radar this year. Some folks mourned for us, he says. I have talked to a few folks about this, and for those who were members, who are part of the movement, they have remained so loyal and true and passionate about our purpose. And that purpose hasn't changed. The real vision and purpose behind Bull City then is the same as it is now, Case says. That is that Durham will be the best place in the world for people improving the world. We see that playing out through the work of social innovators, and we see the opportunity for folks to think creatively. And the next headline on this reporter page, Fire Phone launch fueled locally. Raleigh startup made sure Amazon event went off without a hitch. As the world watched Amazon's recent announcement that it would offer its first ever smartphone, the Fire Phone, a Raleigh entrepreneur is breathing a big sigh of relief. The launch event went off without a hitch because of the company Alan Cook founded in 2004, TorTech. His firm was tapped to make sure the new device has an uninterrupted signal for the demonstration and that media had ample bandwidth to tell you all about it. TorTech, founded first as an IT company for concerts and touring companies, counts pop stars such as Beyonce and Madonna among its clients. The firm now provides high-bandwidth Wi-Fi for major events such as Coachella Music Festival, Lollapalooza, and of course, Amazon's launch. Echoing in the footsteps of other companies that make an event out of product launches, think Apple's celebration every time there's a new iPhone. Amazon is pulling out all the stops. Cook, who just got back to North Carolina, after a week and a half in Seattle prepping for the big event, moved his company here from Los Angeles because, quote, it was time for our kids to get out of L.A., unquote. He didn't set out to start TorTech. In fact, he studied theatrical lighting design, initially designing lighting for corporate events, but lighting and IT started to cross over. Everything is sort of a word-of-mouth transaction, he says. The more people you meet, the more people that ask you for help, and sooner or later, I formed a company specifically to provide IT services to the entertainment industry. It's not his first product launch. He helped orchestrate Amazon's Kindle Fire event and frequently works with the production company contracted to Amazon. But with the buzz about a first-ever product offering, this time feels bigger. Cook tells me the company, which has a staff of 8 and 25 contracts, has 2 team members at the event in Seattle. It's exciting, he says. And now we have a section by the numbers. Where entrepreneurs got their funding in 2013. Entrepreneurial companies in North Carolina collectively raised $461 million through equity investments, grants, and awards in 2013. Of the 108 unique funders involved, 75% of them were from outside the state. 25, North Carolina investors. 24, Northeast investors. 14, Mid-Atlantic Investors. 10, California Investors. 10, Midwest Investors. And 10, Southeast outside of North Carolina Investors. And a quick note in the Tech Talk section. Cloud infrastructure market share trend. The cloud infrastructure equipment market is becoming a two-horse race. That's according to new first quarter data from Synergy Research Group that shows Cisco, which has a growing campus in Research Triangle Park, taking the lead over HP, Hewlett-Packard. IBM appears to be backing out as it sells its low-end server division to Lenovo. And in the final section, tech jobs. The IT job market is expanding in North Carolina. That's according to a recent report sponsored by the North Carolina Technology Association that shows a 4.8% bump in tech jobs in the state, while the national job market grew 0.8% in May. North Carolina bucked the trend, posting an average of 3,260 tech jobs a day, a 4.8% increase over April. But employers don't want just anyone sitting at their cubicles. According to NCTA, they're looking for very specific criteria. And here's a list of the top five job skills employers were looking for in May. SQL, Windows OS, Java, Business Analysis, and Oracle DBMS. And now we turn to the Executive Voice article in the Triangle Business Journal, featuring Billy Cuthrell, and it's headlined, Drumming Up Art Support, Raleigh Artist and Business Owner Carries the Torch for Music Education. And this is written by Don Curry. Billy Cuthrell of Raleigh, founder and CEO of Progressive Music Center, once lived a much different life. His band, Fountain of Youth, toured with the Red Hot Chili Peppers in the early 90s, and during this time he says he bonded with drummer Chad Smith. Since then, the two have been on a mission to encourage public schools across the nation to make the arts a priority. He, Smith, former New York Yankee star Bernie Williams, and actress Sarah Jessica Parker, recently made a visit to Washington, D.C. to address politicians about their mission. I had a very successful week in Washington and consider the meetings a huge success, Cuthrell says. The senators and congressmen were extremely open-minded in our conversations and very receptive to our message. It helped to have some star power with us, so I appreciate Chad Smith, Bernie Williams, and Sarah Jessica Parker lending their voices and celebrity to the cause of music education and the importance of music in our schools. He says that research shows quality music programming in public schools has a direct effect on graduation rates and student retention. I asked Cuthrell a few questions about his passion. How long have you known Chad Smith? I've known Chad for 20 years or more now. I had a band and toured with the Red Hot Chili Peppers when they had some regional success in the early 90s. We had some of the same management as those guys. We kind of lost touch with them for about 10 years or more. How did you reconnect? I ended up being asked to serve on the executive board for the Percussion Marketing Council. One of the other guys on the board was Brad Smith, Chad's brother. I was in L.A. and Brad invited me to a party. We're in the car and we're driving up to Hollywood Hills, passing Madonna's house, and we ended up at Chad's house. Chad ended up being the spokesperson for the council. What is it that you and Chad have in common? Chad and I are very similar. I just don't have the Grammys to show for it. I was about to get kicked out of school when I was in the ninth grade. I had been kicked out of class again and was standing in the hallway. Here comes the band director and he's like, "You're out here again? I see you out here all the time. What's going on with you?" he says. He says, "Come to my band class tomorrow afternoon and see what you think. Just give it a try." I didn't want to go down there surrounded by nerds, but I went anyway. By about an hour later, I was totally bought in and left a totally different person. One night in a bar in Pittsburgh after a show, someone asked Chad how he got into music, and he told the same story. That has always stuck with me. Is this what brings you to your current mission? Oh, absolutely. Music transcends people, no matter what your background is. That's one of the most incredible things about this. Tell me about your band. We were called Fountain of Youth, based out of Greenville. It was sort of a self-produced thing. We had a few hits in college radio and were in the back of Rolling Stone, and pretty soon we started doing opening acts. That's how we met up with the Red Hot Chili Peppers. How does this experience influence your business today? I've got 3 locations and about 600 students. For instance, when the Red Hot Chili Peppers came to play in town about 2 years ago, Chad asked me if I had any students that wanted to come to the show. We brought about 20 students that were big Red Hot Chili Pepper fans. Chad took them backstage, then down to the dressing rooms. He got them really good seats. Does Chad come to the Triangle often? It's rare. He's got family in Wilmington, so he comes to see them. I've got a store in Wilmington, too, so sometimes we get to catch up down there. And in the Closer Look section, name, Billy Cuthrell, title, founder and CEO, company, Progressive Music Center, age, 40, residence, Wendell, family, wife, Jennifer, and daughter, Emma, first job, stocking shelves at a discount chain store. And in the People on the Move section in the Triangle Business Journal, the spotlight is on Joanna Helms, Economic Development Director for the town of Apex. Though she's a product of Syracuse, New York, Joanna Helms grew up in southwest Wake County and attended high school in Apex. And now she's been tapped to bring big business to town, whose motto is the peak of good living. She starts on July 21. My long-term goal has always been to get back home once my sons graduated high school and were in college, Helms says, so the position in Apex was a divine opportunity. As Economic Development Director for the town of Apex, Helms will work to establish a comprehensive EcoDevo program and expand existing business, recruit new business, and to develop product, i.e. buildings and sites that are designed to create new jobs and bring investment into the Apex community. What's one thing you wish people knew about your job? That economic development is a process, not a project. It takes proper funding, it takes bold leadership, and it takes perseverance and patience. What are some of your major goals in this position? We'll be taking a look at some short-term and long-term goals once I begin. It would be premature to assume anything specific until then, but I imagine the goals will revolve around proven economic development principles that I have practiced for over 20 years. Biggest pet peeve? Rude people. Triangle business person you most admire? There are many, but a few would be Catherine Thomas, now with Alfred Williams & Company, and also Ernie Pearson with Nexen Pruitt and Sanford Holzhauser Economic Development Consulting. Now we turn to the Viewpoint page in the Triangle Business Journal, and the first guest column is written by David Zondermann, who is a professor of history at NC State University in Raleigh. The headline on his guest column, Unemployment Benefit Cuts Should Be Restored. The North Carolina General Assembly is about done with its short session, but there's still time to restore some of the cuts made last year to the state's unemployment compensation system. Doing this would benefit needy citizens and the entire economy. We could do it without breaking the state's budget, and we could pay back loans from the federal government to replenish the Unemployment Insurance Trust Fund without making the least among us bear that burden. Restoring the cuts would boost the average benefit by $225 each month, money that needy families would spend on necessities. Every dollar spent generates another dollar of economic growth. This wouldn't impact the state budget. Employers pay into that trust fund, which the federal government administers as protection against the risk that job loss driven by economic cycles has on their businesses. Unemployment compensation is paid out of these funds, and states can get loans from the federal government to help pay claims in times of high rates of job loss. Cutting benefits is not the fair way to pay back the federal government. In good times, back in the 1990s, the legislature cut taxes for employers to artificially low rates and thus failed to build up the trust fund for when it was needed, like today. Through reduced benefits, the unemployed are shouldering 2/3 of the cost of federal loans to pay benefits over the past 5 years. employers are contributing 22.5%. So those least able to bear the burden are asked to sacrifice their modest compensation while businesses continue to pay lower unemployment taxes. Cutting the benefits hasn't motivated people to find jobs. The recent drop in our unemployment rate is largely due to people leaving the workforce because they can't find jobs and not because of significant job growth. And the other guest column is written by John Hood, who is president of the John Locke Foundation, a Raleigh-based think tank. And the headline on his column, North Carolina should employ fewer, pay more. If Governor Pat McCrory and the General Assembly enact a 2014 to 2015 budget that eliminates some government positions in order to fund pay raises for other government employees, they'll get criticized in the usual manner by the usual people. So what? Such a decision would be consistent with the available data about how public employment in our state compares to that of other states. North Carolina governments have long been above average in staffing levels and at or below average in employee compensation. Despite the elimination of thousands of positions in state and local government during the Great Recession, North Carolina remains overstaffed by national standards. According to 2012 data from the Census Bureau, North Carolina had about 564,000 full-time equivalent positions in state and local government. That's the proper measure to use. You can't use a simple count of all positions because states vary in their use of full-timers and part-timers. Similarly, you can't look only at state government because states vary in how they fund and staff services such as education and law enforcement. In some places, for example, teachers are primarily funded at the state level and classified as state employees. In other places, teachers are predominantly funded by local revenues and classified as such. NC, 12% higher. Combining these public employment figures with population estimates yields a public employment rate for each state. For 2012, North Carolina had 578 FTE state and local employees per 10,000 residents. That was 12% higher than the national average rate of 517 per 10,000 residents. And that FTE is full-time employees. On the other hand, we know that North Carolina doesn't rank particularly high when it comes to public employee compensation. Even after adjusting for state differences in cost of living, the value of non-wage benefits, years of experience, and other factors, North Carolina's teachers aren't compensated above the national average at this point and are likely somewhat below it. A new study from the American Enterprise Institute suggests a different way to quantify the effect. In general, authors Andrew Biggs and Jason Richwine find that state and local employees across the country have higher compensation than do comparable private sector workers in their communities. Note the distinction. Note the term compensation as distinguished from pay. In many cases, salaries for public employees might be lower than salaries received by private workers with similar levels of experience, education, and job responsibilities. But when Biggs and Richwine factor in the value of non-wage benefits, public employees come out ahead in most states. In Connecticut, for instance, public employees make an average of 42% more than comparable private workers. The premium is 35% in Pennsylvania, 34% in New York, and 23% in California. In North Carolina, however, the average compensation differential between comparable public and private workers is essentially nil. That doesn't mean our public employees are horribly treated. Given the fact that they are still less likely to lose their jobs than private employees are, state government isn't going to go out of business, they've still got a fairly good thing going. That's one reason vacant positions in state and local government still attract lots of applicants. But because this is an average, there is no doubt that for some categories of public employees, North Carolina's compensation is relatively low. After all, having lots of applicants isn't the same thing as having lots of highly qualified applicants. Reasonable, data-driven policymakers might well look at these statistics and conclude that North Carolina ought to reduce its public employment rate and use much of the savings to fund compensation increases for high-priority jobs such as classroom teachers or assistant district attorneys. And with our remaining minutes, we'll read as much as we can of the small business column headlined, Handing Down the Legacy of a Family-Owned Company, How to Balance Intergenerational Differences in Management Style. Whatever happened to working hard and saving money? My friend Carl put his elbows on the table and shook his head in bewilderment. We were into our weekly mid-morning coffee and state-of-the-world debate at the Carolina Moon Cafe. I grew up with those ideas, and they've been part of my personal philosophy and my business philosophy for 50 years. No question about it, I said. You've built a successful company by working hard and saving money, and now that your kids have come into the business, they'll have a wonderful legacy to enjoy. To tell you the truth, I'm concerned about that, he said. Both of my sons and even my daughter seem more interested in enjoying the legacy than in protecting it and keeping it in the family. They don't strike me as profligate children. No, they're good people, Carl said, but their view of the money the business makes is that it's there to be spent, not conserved. They want the profits distributed, and they want the world to know that we're a successful family. That makes you uncomfortable? Yeah, I guess it really does. My idea has always been that you keep your financial situation to yourself, that you earn as much as you can honestly, and that you build family wealth by being conservative. Carl shook his head again. Not these kids, though. I don't know where they're coming from. You know, Carl, I said, I think your family is getting into a good old-fashioned intergenerational values conflict. All that means is that your kids' values have been shaped by their life experience, so their values are different in some important ways from the values that you've developed from your experience. What you're seeing now is those two sets of values in some disagreement. And skipping to the end of the article, he mentions, the important thing is to sit down together right now and talk about them. Start by recognizing that your different experiences have given you and your children different perspectives. And we'll have to stop there. As we run out of time for today's episode of Triangle Business Journal, be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Derek Frost, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. The program is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast. You can contact us at 919-832-5138. So long until next time.